The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
So, dear friends, one-on-one, we're going to go deep dive here on America First on matters of geopolitics and strategy. You know the stuff I love. Why? Because we are on the brink of another war in Europe. We've had to save Europe twice already in the last century. We're going to have to do it again. Let's remind the world of what it was like when we were in the White House. The president's name was Donald Trump, and he didn't invade any countries. But he used force judiciously. Cut one.
I was sitting at the table. We had finished dinner. We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it. And I said, Mr. President, let me explain something to you. This is during dessert. So what happens is I said, we've just launched 59 missiles heading to Iraq.
Well, you headed to Syria.
Yes, heading toward Syria.
Over chocolate cake, geostrategy and chocolate cake. Who better to discuss it with than a man who has been senior director in the National Security Council at DASD. That's Washington speak for Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. He's senior fellow with the Hudson Institute. And we just love to have him here because he cackles and laughs whenever we mention Max Boot. Michael Duran, welcome to America First One-on-One.
Great to be here. I feel guilty when I do that, though.
But it was so heartfelt. We've got the video. We're digging it up right now. You and our buddy, Jim Carafano, we played a clip of... What was Eric, do you remember what the phrase was Max Boot mentioned?
He was describing President Trump's foreign policy towards Iran as, quote, bellicose isolationism.
Bellicose isolationism. And when you guys heard that, you just barely laughed on live radio.
Yeah. I do feel guilty, though, because Max and I were very good friends. We used to write articles together.
But that's when he was still sane, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what happened.
Well, you know what's happened. It's called TDS, and it's real. Yeah. Trump Derangement Syndrome is real.
It is real.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Let's do a little survey of the last 12 months, if you will, from your perch. You specialize on the Middle East. You have a canny sense of the geopolitical. Did you expect it? And you don't have to do partisan politics here, but let's just talk geopolitics, geostrategy. Did you expect the international system to be as unstable as quickly as it has become?
No, I expected bad things, but things are worse than I expected. It's so bad that I don't get any partisan pleasure out of it because I'm worried about the United States.
So can you put down some of the major factors and the ingredients of why that happened? For me, it's enemies who feel reassured and friends who are worried. Could you unpack
it? That's it. That's exactly what it is. I mean, because what Biden is doing is this is the third term of Obama, and the centerpiece of his policy is appeasement of Iran, and I say that appeasement not as a slur word. That is what they're trying to do. They're trying to come to an accommodation with Iran by giving it pretty much all that it wants.
Okay, I got to stop you there. You're, running some amazing research projects at Hudson on the threat of Iran. For those who are fed up with 20 years of what President Trump called, the dumb wars, the stupid wars, can you really explain in the panoply of national security threats why Iran is different and why we have to take it so seriously?
Iran is the ally of Russia and China, and it is the instrument with which the two of them are using to undermine the American order in the Middle East. So that basically what's going to happen if we don't wise up is China is going to take over the Middle East, and then it's going to control the global oil, the global trade in oil, it's going to use that position then to detach Europe from the United States and to gain advantage over its enemies in East Asia.
Right.
If you just look at it from the We can look at it from the Chinese point of view. You can look at it from the Iranian point of view. From the Russian point of view. Let's start with the Russians, since it's on everybody's mind.
Yes.
There's a direct connection between Ukraine and the Middle East. Because the Sevastopol in Crimea, so Putin took Crimea in 2014. Sevastopol is the port there. That is the warm water port that the Russians looked for centuries. It is the hub of their operations in the Middle East. There's two hubs. There's Sevastopol, and then there's Tartus in Syria. So Iran and Russia are allies in Syria to prop up Assad, and there's a direct connection between Crimea and Sevastopol and Tartus in Syria. So a free, independent, democratic Ukraine would seek to take back Crimea and would threaten Russia's position on the Black Sea. If you have an independent Ukraine, and it is either part of NATO or working with NATO, and let's say it's allied with Turkey on the other side of the Black Sea, then you can basically shut Russia out of the Middle East. So there's a direct connection there, and the Russian position in Syria depends on its alignment with Iran. Because Iran has the position on the ground. The Russians give the air cover. The Iranians have the troops on the ground to prop up Assad.
Let's focus. You're connecting the pieces in this big geopolitical jigsaw puzzle. Let's focus exclusively for a moment on Iran. Why is Iran not Belgium? Why is Iran not Vanuatu? Why is Iran so very different in terms of its position and its ambitions in the international system?
It's the strangest thing, Iran, because Iran in some ways is objectively weak. Its economy has been, Trump devastated the economy and the its economic situation.
It almost completely collapsed.
It's a terrible situation. Unemployment is high. The currency has been devalued time and time again. And you can look at it and see it's very weak. However, it does have the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And they have developed a model, let's call it the Hezbollah model, of projecting power around the region. And
But not necessarily directly with their own units. I'll unpack how they do that
They do it by building up proxies. They go in under these societies, especially in the Arab world, they're fragmented societies. Like Iraq, we know how fragmented Iraq is. And the Iranians go in under the noses of the leaders, and they'll build up militias that the leaders cannot control, and those militias then they either carry out acts of subversion against the government, or they cajole the government to move in the direction they want. And the key one is Hezbollah. Hezbollah basically controls Lebanon now. It's convenient for Hezbollah not to be seen to be totally controlling the government, because that allows the elements in the government, which are totally beholden to Hezbollah, really, to interact with other players outside, like the United States. Like we're building right now the Lebanese armed forces. We pay for that, but Hezbollah controls the country. I don't think we should be doing that anymore. At one point, the idea was, well, there are parts of this society that are independent from Hezbollah, and we need to build those up and so on. I think it's now kind of a con game.
And what is the objective for Iran? Russia we see as nostalgia for the Soviet Union. We see a anti-status quo actor creating eddies in the currents to profit their own geopolitics. What is Iran's big end strategy?
It wants to undermine the American order in the region. That's this is still the Islamic Republic, and it still had the leadership still has a worldview that was molded by the Islamic extremism of the Iranian Revolution, but it has also morphed a little bit. I think the analogy now is kind of like the Soviet Union in the last couple of decades.
Sclerotic.
Do people on the street, does the ideology of the regime
permeate down?
No, they don't really believe in it. But yet they've built a certain system, and they are prisoners of that system. So you can't if they were to renounce the fundamentals of the Islamic Revolution, then they wouldn't have the relationship with Hezbollah, for example.
Right.
So some of it's ideological, but what's crept in there? I mean, some of it's Islamic extremism, Shiite extremism, but Persian nationalism has crept into it.
And Persian nationalism is far, far older than the Iranian Revolution. We're going to keep unpacking it because of the feckless, astrategic behavior of the current administration with senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Michael Duran, former senior director of the National Security Council for Middle Eastern Affairs, and also Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense formerly. This is America First One-on-One. If you enjoy the deep dive with guests who actually know of what they speak and are newsmakers themselves, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts, such as Spotify. Just look for my name, Sebastian Gorka, America First. Subscribe today, spread the word, write us a review, and you'll never miss a thing. Dear friends, if you haven't done so already, I really encourage you to join me and Dinesh D'Souza for our Stand With Israel tour. 10 days this November, December in the Holy Land to walk where our Lord and Savior walked the earth. We're going to all the key sites, the ancient city of Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, the Holy Church of the Sepulchre, the Sea of Galilee, Caesarea, you name it, Capernaum. Please reserve your tickets for the trip of a lifetime. Even if you've been to Israel, you haven't been with me and Dinesh. Call today, 855-565. I can see Mike's nodding his head. I think he's going to join us. That's 855-565-5519. Mark Morgan, former CBP commissioner, says he's going to come with us. It's going to be a blast. Come on, guys, 855-565-5519. Or just go to standwithisraeltour.com. That's standwithisraeltour.com. Whether it's the regular Hellcat or whether it's the compensated RDP with that miniature red dot, I love them all. How did it take so long to invent a factory compensated subcompact 9mm? Well, guess what? Springfield did it, and I'm a huge fan, and I'm Sebastian Gorka.
The Hellcat from Springfield Armory is still the smallest, highest-capacity micro-compact in the world. Available in standard or optics-ready configurations, the class-leading capacity of the Hellcat gives you 11+1 with the standard magazine and 13+1 with the included extended mag. The definitive concealed carry pistol is here. The Hellcat from Springfield Armory gives you the capacity to defend.
Mike, you mentioned right at the beginning that the central pillar, I think you said, of the Biden administration is Iran and the revivification of the JCPOA Obama-Iran deal. I'm a rational man. I think I'm a pragmatist. I haven't yet had anybody explain to me why on God's green earth an American party, an American administration, would build its legacy around relations with a regime that wishes to destroy America. Can you explain that for me?
I can do that. I can do that. But it's really easy if you forget about geopolitics, because it's not geopolitics. It's progressive politics masquerading as strategy.
So it's domestically oriented foreign policy.
Yes.
Okay, unpack that for us.
So the basic idea is what it does, this policy, the Iran engagement, is it takes all of those actors that progressives hate anyway, evangelical Christians, security-minded Republicans in general, people who want to go on Stand With Israel tours.
Our listeners.
Our millions of listeners.
Right.
We're
the problem.
You are the problem. That's right. What it does. Your listeners. It takes you together with Bibi Netanyahu, Mohammed bin Salman, right? And it says they are Donald Trump, right? They are the problem.
Because?
They are the party of war. Think about how...
As we're deploying 9,000 troops to Russia.
Think about how Obama sold the Iran nuclear deal. It was either war or this ridiculous,
yes, right,
horrible
right,
deal.
Right, 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 right. So, either $150 billion or war.
Yeah. So right. if you're against the, basically building up the Islamic Republic, you're for war. You're the party of war. And so it creates this this vision of the Middle East where all the conflict is caused by the party of war, and it turns Iran doesn't become the party of peace, but it becomes the object of diplomacy. And that's what we're for. We're not for war.
But that's
war.
Insanity. We're talking about Shiite fundamentalists who throw gay people off the top of roofs.
No. That's very unsophisticated of you.
Sorry, I'm a Luddite Neanderthal.
Yeah, you're no, because they believe, and they're not. By the way, they're not entirely wrong here. Just like I was saying that we say it's a sclerotic regime now,
right?
It's gotten weaker, and there's a very pragmatic element to the Iranians. They are practitioners of power.
Well, they know how to squeeze everything out of a negotiation without giving anything. I would call that pragmatic.
But also they have on their northern border they have Azerbaijan, which is a Shiite country,
right?
And but they support Armenia, the Christian country, against Azerbaijan. They have about 20 million Azerbaijanis in Iran, and they're afraid of a separatist movement.
Right.
So they get over their commitment to Islam.
Okay,
very easily.
So let's stop talking about their pragmatism.
Just to finish, because that's the fact that they do have this pragmatic streak. It allows the Biden administration, people like Rob Malley, who are running the policy, to get past people like you who are saying, well, they're hanging gays from cranes. You know, they're saying, no, they're very pragmatic. They're very pragmatic. And look, when I was in the White House, it's amazing. The two regimes that do this extremely well are the Iranians and the Syrians.
Yeah.
And back then, it was in the Bush administration, and we didn't really have much contact with the Iranians. But they would send us messages all the time through intermediaries. And the messages were, you know, we are pragmatic people. You have your extremists, we have ours, but we have a lot of interests in common. Let's work together. How come you're so close to the Saudis and Israelis?
I'm not the guy throwing people off roofs, so talk to me.
Yeah, talk to me, and we can, okay, so I have to throw a few guys off roofs every now and then just to show that I'm committed to these ideas because I have these hardliners over here, but I want to cut a deal. And it does, there's a certain kind of American who sees himself as being very sophisticated and worldly and a man of affairs who wants to cut a deal.
When in fact they're stupid.
In this case, yes, because they're being conned.
But so again, sorry for the naive Luddite Neanderthal questions, but after, what has it been, 43 years, why does anybody here on any political side of the aisle think that Iran can be trusted?
You know, it's another thing I learned in the White House is that there is nothing less factual in the world than intentions, right? You never, like, I catch you with your hand in the cookie jar and I say, Seb, you're stealing cookies. Oh no! I intended to reach for my keys. I did. I didn't know there were cookies in there. Right?
So self-delusion.
What they believe is that what Iran really wants is a productive relationship with the United States. All the terrorism and everything is really just a way to get some leverage over the United States to get its attention, so that we share so much in common.
So killing Americans, Jews, Brits across the planet from Argentina to Europe is what, a negotiating tactic?
Well, there was a time when the crazies were in charge, but they're not in charge of that. We still have some of them in our system.
So we're placating the crazies.
We have to keep the crazies in check, and if we can develop a more productive relationship, it will. This is the Americans not talking. If we develop a more productive relationship, it will shift. It will shift the calculations.
Good guys, will take over in Iran, right?
Well, or maybe they don't actually believe that, but they believe that we can shift Khamenei's calculus. We can make him vested in the relationship.
Because that's happened how many times in the last 43 years?
Hasn't been working so well. I mean, it was the same idea. Look, this is a profoundly American mistake, right? We did it with China as well. We thought if we become the economic partners with China, then that will change the calculus in Beijing, and they'll never think about trying to topple us as the dominant power in the world. It hasn't worked so well. But that's the idea.
I'm glad that our guest has such a wry sense of humor, and he does, because otherwise, I don't know, in this city. We're going to talk about the lack of imaginative thinking in this city. He is the author of Ike's Gambit, correct?
Gamble.
Ike's Gamble. I like Gambit better. For the next edition, it'll be Gambit. Oh, there it is, up on the screen. Ike's Gamble, America's Rise to Dominance in the Middle East, former Senior Director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. That's called a DASD. And he's now a Senior Fellow at Hudson. Please follow him on Twitter at Doranimated. This is America First, coming to you live from the ReliefFactor.com studios. Dear friends, we've all been there. You get out of the shower, out of the bath, reach for the towel, and it's like sanding yourself down with a piece of cardboard. Why? Michael Lindell worked it out. They were importing towels from abroad, adding softness, and when you get home, it's just a con. Do what we've done. Order the incredible new MyPillow towels made with American cotton right here in the United States. Soft and absorbent as long as you own them. The six-piece set, two bath towels, two hand towels, two washcloths, regularly $109.99. You gonna get them for $39.99. If you use my name, go to MyPillow.com, click on the new radio list of specials for deep, deep discounts with promo code G-O-R-K-A. You've never tried a towel like it. 1-800-829-8468. 1-800-829-8468. MyPillow.com. Promo code G-O-R-K-A. Mike, I there's so many things I'd like to talk to you about. Let's, for once on the record, talk about this thing that clearly, whatever happens in Russia, this administration is still obsessed with Iran, still obsessed with Obama's JCPOA Iran deal, which for me was the proudest moment of our administration, where Steve Bannon and myself managed to create the conditions for the president to kill the deal. Why is it...
That was great.
Oh, my gosh. When he called us into the Oval with the rest of the cabinet members there who were pro-Iran deal and said, okay, he called us his heavies, and he said, Steve, Seb, explain why I need to kill this. And we had a great session, and the president killed it.
It's wonderful.
Why is it so bad? And will you explain why it didn't, in fact, stop Iran getting nuclear capability?
Well, that's it. It doesn't do
it says,
at all what they said it does. Right. Not at all. Right. Not at all. It leaves them... So the theory of the JCPOA is that it blocks all paths to a bomb, and it keeps them 1 year away from being a threshold state, meaning having enough fissile material to build a bomb. It doesn't do that. I mean, just if you look at the terms of it, all the restrictions melt away over time.
Right. So after 10 years, they do whatever they want.
They do it, yeah, exactly, and so they can continue to blackmail us with their quasi nuclear status or their threshold status, and then it lifts all the sanctions, and so it makes them flush with cash, which they can use to fund their proxies who are attacking our allies. Like right now, we're seeing them. They're attacking, well, through their proxies, through the Houthis, are attacking the UAE.
Do you think the disastrous evolution of events in Ukraine could put a brake on the JCPOA deal being resuscitated?
I think it's going to make it harder. It depends on the mood in the. It depends on the mood in the country. I believe it will. There are a lot of people on our side who are saying, "Oh, to hell with Ukraine! What do we care?" and so on. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I understand.
Can you give us your response to that? Because we see it every day on my social media feeds. Who cares? Blah blah blah. How about the southern border? Can you give us your response, Mike?
Well, it doesn't stop with Ukraine. I mean, anyone who when people say, "Oh, we should," you know, traditionally Russia has been the dominant power there, we don't want to, you know. Tucker Carlson said, "What if China put their military in Mexico and so on?" That's not the issue for Putin. Putin doesn't feel threatened by NATO. Part of what he's doing in Ukraine is showing just how divided NATO is. Germany's on the side of on his side of this in this thing. It's what he doesn't want is an independent Ukraine. right next to him, yeah, because that's gonna undermine his regime in,
it's
in
gonna,
Russia.
It's gonna influence people in Russia.
Yeah, exactly, and he's got, and it doesn't stop with Ukraine. After Ukraine, it's gonna be the Baltic states,
NATO nations, Hungary, like Poland. Czechoslovakia.
Poland is a dagger at him as right. well, as far as he's concerned.
But again, let me just.
And by the way, in the negotiations, he made that clear because he said, "I want you to go back to 1997. Bulgaria is mine." Right.
So, but let's play devil's advocate. Okay, then why should we care about any of those states? We don't want to go to war for Poland either, although it's a NATO nation. Respond to that critique.
Because we care about our freedom. Our freedom is built on our economic system. And we've already seen what China and Russia are. Russia is not acting alone here.
No.
Russia is the ally of China, and it's the junior ally. And they want to. China wants to unmake the American system, the American-led system, and we've already seen enough to understand what that means. The kind of intimidation that China has done with Australia, with Canada. I mean, countries that are extremely close to us. You wouldn't have thought the sort of bullying. We can already see what they've done here in our own country. The Chinese. I mean, they've infiltrated our universities. They've taken over. They have infiltrated our business elite. They have much more influence here than anyone realized until Donald Trump came along.
Yeah.
And it's very worrying. So if they take over the global economy, if they take over the fossil fuel economy, which is we're already seeing now. Part of the reason that Germany is supporting Putin is because German gas. Because the Russians provide over 40% of Germany's gas. Now the Biden administration, with all of its green energy policies, is kind of happy to hand all fossil fuels to the countries that want to undermine us. It's even worse than that, because the Chinese also have a near monopoly on solar panels and everything else.
Yes.
So we're building a global energy system that China dominates. That's ultimately the threat. Ultimately, our freedom is based on this global economic system. We cannot have a successful free capitalist system in the United States alone. So we have to care about Europe, even if the Ukrainian government. Everyone points out all the time it's corrupt for sure. There are a lot of great people there. First of all, though, I was there a couple of years ago with Jim Carafano, by the way, and we met a lot of very brave, patriotic people who are risking their lives.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't forget that. And they want to fight, right? So those people want to fight. So they're not asking us to do it for them. But the country does have lots of problems, no doubt. But I would define it as a geopolitical pivot. It's extremely important territory.
Yes.
Regardless of it doesn't matter if we like the people there, we don't like them, we think they're virtuous, we don't think they're virtuous. We don't want Putin to have that, because once he has that, he grows a lot stronger all across the board, and that's going to cause other problems for us.
Yeah, there's a reason that it was called the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. There's a reason that Stalin killed at least 7 or 8 million Ukrainians during the Holodomor. This is America First, one-on-one with me, your host, Sebastian Gorka. Mike, can you help me with something? I'm going to go a little bit off base here. We haven't rehearsed any of this. We don't clear talking points with our guests. But you're an expert in the Middle East. I half an hour ago talked about our Stand With Israel tour. Now and again, I'll get people slide into my DMs on Twitter, or they'll retweet me or comment and say, Sebastian Gorka, he's not America First, he's Israel First, right? The guy who was supposed to be the racist, anti-Semite, Trump.
They haven't been reading the right...
Yeah, right, they're not reading the Daily Beast, I guess. So, you know, from the right, I get this, because I'm pro-Israel. I think it's the centerpiece of our policy in the Middle East, the only functioning democracy in the Middle East.
Right.
How do you deal with this on the right? I mean, Hudson is a conservative think tank. We're not doing party politics. But where does this come from? Where does this anti-Israeli strain come from? Is it old? Because in Europe, I saw it all the time, but that's ancient anti-Semitic cultural baggage.
Right.
Is this left over from the 1930s in America? Is this a more violent version of Pat Buchanan? And how do we deal with it? I get the racism of Rashida Tlaib or AOC's BDS support, but on the right, we shouldn't have this problem.
No, it exists on the right, for sure. And it's actually from the same source on the right and on the left. It used to, if you go back to, say, Eisenhower's day, because I studied a lot of this when I wrote the Ike's Gamble.
Gamble, right.
Yeah. Actually went deeply into it, not in the book, just for the research.
Right.
It's something I'm very, very interested in.
So tell us where it comes from.
It comes from, this is not about Israel.
Is this about isolationism?
No, it's about America. It's a struggle for the soul of America.
Explain.
Good title for a book. Huh?
That would be a great title for a book.
Yeah. It's Protestant modernism versus fundamentalism, evangelical Christianity.
Interesting.
The big divide is in the big split comes in the 20s. You know, remember with the Scopes Monkey Trial,
yes.
and so forth.
Yes.
Okay. There's a fault line,
which is actually theological.
Theological. This is theological.
This is interesting. Okay, I want to hear about this.
So it's basically theological, and on one side of the divide, you have people who believe that human nature is malleable.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, a man can become a woman, right? Right. We can perfect humanity. And on the other side, people who believe that human nature is fixed.
That's which is the evangelical or not?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, we're kind of in a post-Christian country now. But we still have this theological divide.
So where does the anti-Semitism come in?
Well, Israel is on the line. Zionism is on the line, on that fault line in American culture.
Unpack that.
So the all of the leading lights of Protestant modernism in the 1920s were anti-Zionists.
Why?
Because it goes back to literal interpretation of the Bible.
Ah, okay.
Right? And so
explain that.
So if you believe that the Bible is the Word of God, right, then you and if you believe that our values come from God and that they are fixed and that our nature comes from God and it is fixed, right, then you're going to have one attitude toward Israel and toward the Jewish people.
Which is
in support of.
Okay.
Right. And America, if you go back and look at in America in its earliest days.
But why does that make you hate Israel if you don't believe that? Why does it have to get to that vituperative anti-Israel?
Because it's really a three-meter, the three-meter fight is really not about Jews or in America. It's not really about Jews or Israel. It's about evangelicals and people who believe in a fixed human nature.
Right. So it's a nature of man argument.
It's a nature of man argument. And wow. The nature and the purpose of the United States. What's the purpose of the United States now? If I guarantee it's a huge litmus test, right? If you tell me you tell me how you feel about Israel, I'll tell you how you feel about gender malleability. I'll tell you about
everything.
How you feel about American
taxes,
exceptionalism.
Borders.
It's all.
Right.
So I really vote on one issue. I vote on Israel. That's it. Infallible.
So
never meet anybody that's that believes in American exceptionalism and hates Israel.
That's good. So how do we deal with those who say they're conservatives but are isolationists and anti-Israel?
Well, that's the whole thing. Is you found out this is what Trump opened up.
Yeah.
And I had no idea it was coming, right? But Trump opened up this divide. So I found out that a lot of I came to Washington on the coattails of the neocons, and I used to joke I didn't know myself well enough. I didn't know the country well enough to really understand exactly what I was saying at the time. But I used to joke when people would call me a neocon. I never really felt
pejorative.
No, well, I never really felt that I was a neocon.
Oh, okay.
But I would say that no, I'm not a neocon. I'm a running dog of the neocon. Right?
You have an interesting sense of humor, Mike. I have to tell you.
But then Trump came along, and then like people like Max Boot, right? Max went one direction, I went the other, and I tried to talk to them. I took $75 off Max Boot. I took $75 off of Brett Stevens.
On what? On who would
on
win?
On Ruel Gerecht. On who would win? Yeah. And back in April, because I recognized that Trump was speaking for a certain part of the country.
Yeah.
Trump has
had a, geopolitically in America, he has had a catalytic effect, has he not?
Unbelievable.
Is it lasting?
It's amazing. Yeah. I think he's an historic figure. I really do. It's not. I'm not sure how much he knows. It's just instinct. He has a certain
understanding. He has preternatural instincts.
Yeah, he's got a certain understanding of America, and he wants to move things in that direction. But You know, if you take the China question,
yeah.
Did you know before Donald Trump, did you know that the NBA was in bed with China?
No.
I didn't know this.
But I knew that he had been talking about it since the 80s. I mean, on Oprah Winfrey.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And nobody was like, who cares?
And it sounded like the ravings of a madman.
Right. People didn't pay attention, didn't make the news. Yeah. Yeah. This isn't just something that was born overnight. This is something that he's been thinking about for years.
Well, you know, it's funny because, like, when I was a kid, my dad liked to buy American. My dad wouldn't buy a foreign car. My mother made him buy a Fiat just before they got divorced, and he hated it. And he used to complain about it all the time. It's funny. So there's those attitudes. Trump is a throwback to that.
There is something atavistic in a positive sense with that attitude, and it really is how working class Americans can rave for a billionaire from Manhattan. This is America First, one-on-one, and we're talking to Mike Doran. Mike, we're almost out of time, and I'm really annoyed. I could do this for hours. I just want to push one button to get your response to. Why is it that somebody, and you know, this will be added to the conspiracy theories about Gawker, but I cut my teeth in the Rand Corporation. I was an analyst there in the 1990s. So I know the think tank community in D.C. Why is it just so prosaic? Why is it so proletarian and unimaginative and just pedestrian, Mike? I mean, with the odd exceptions, people who come on. It's a bunch of pedestrian mediocrities, Mike.
No, I can't. I'm sorry. I can't.
You know, no names. You don't have to talk about names.
No, I can't. I just certain things.
Are you
going to
take the fifth? Really?
I'm taking the fifth.
Here?
Yeah, I take the fifth.
Absolutely. Oh, come on. Are you impressed with the think tank community?
Absolutely.
Writ large?
Absolutely, yeah.
I might have to put him on the naughty list. Might have to put Doran on the naughty list.
No.
Come on, we have to tease you out. No, you're going to have to say something.
No, listen, you don't...
Hey, Max Boot isn't listening. It's okay.
He's not, is he?
No. he's definitely not. Media Matters is listening, but Max Boot isn't. All right,
the sound of your voice makes Max an aneurysm. Yeah.
Let me tease you out this way. So I love this story that I witnessed when I was a professor at National Defense University. We had Ed Lutwak come to talk about his latest book, and I love Ed. I think he's one of the few true strategists alive today. And he was talking about the Byzantine Empire book. And at the end, I got to ask him a question. I said, Professor Lutwak, what do you say to those who see America as just astrategic, as not acting in a smart, strategic fashion for 20 years? And he said, classic Ed, well, what is the point of being a superpower if you can't be stupid? there is some verity to that, is there not, Mike?
Yeah, I wonder. When I look at Putin, I just wrote a massive article I'm going to send to you about Azerbaijan.
Please.
And I followed Putin very carefully on the Karabakh conflict. And he just through a very limited use of power, grabbed this territory, the Lachin corridor. It doesn't matter, but it gives him enormous leverage over both Armenia and Azerbaijan.
A very small expenditure.
Yeah, and so having so many enemies surrounding him. And being so big and vulnerable, and having limited military force,
you got to be smart.
You got to be smart. You got to think all the time. Now, in their system, they've only got one guy at the top, and he happens to be very smart. So he can do that.
I would like us to be as smart as a stone cold KGB killer. In the meantime, I have one thing to do, which is to thank our guest, and I know his colleagues at Hudson are going to enjoy this. We're going to give him something from our swag store. It's the t-shirt we made for when President Trump came on the show. If you're woke, you're a loser. I know he will be wearing it around the offices. I'm Sebastian Gorka.
All the time, all around town.
check out the store, sebgorkastore.com. It's been far too much fun, far too brief. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, keep your head in a swivel, watch your six, hold the line, never give up. Never give in and stay frosty.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn. deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.